The first speaker we have today is Sarah Rasmussen. She's been with EPA for over 15 years, working on the RCRA site revitalization issues since 2001. She's currently a team leader for the RCRA Reuse and Brownfield Prevention Work Group. Sarah has worked with EPA's Office of Solid Waste as an analyst conducting regulatory, economic, and risk analyses for RCRA regulations. She was a branch manager for a few years, and she's senior staff in the RCRA Corrective Actions Program. Prior to joining EPA, Sarah worked for several years as a senior legislative staff in Congress, and she's also worked as a consultant. So we welcome Sarah and look forward to her presentation.
Thank you, Michelle. I will start out by saying if any of you have problems hearing me, feel free to interrupt at any time. And I know also that you can be typing in questions.
Right.
And if you have a problem, you can type that in as well. We're going to be monitoring the screen here, so feel free to do that. I also want to say thank you to Michelle for putting on this series of seminars. I remember some years ago it was very hard to figure out what was going on in the area of ecological restoration, and to have a series like this where we just are getting all sorts of resources presented, I think is wonderful. And I want to say this is a great thing to do and encourage everybody to keep checking back on that CLUIN webpage, because I'm sure we're going to be adding resources as they go along, and I think it'll be a nice focal point for us. I also want to say thank you to all those people who work on the CLUIN, because these sessions are valuable for us. I work with the RCRA program, and the RCRA program is authorized in most of the states, and most of our RCRA program, state program people don't get to travel much. So I know several sit in on these sessions, and I've heard over and over again how much they appreciate it. Because we're the third session, I'm sure I'm going to overlap quite a bit with some of the things that have been said before, so bear with me. My task today, which I was told, is to basically talk about some resources that we use in the RCRA program with regard to ecological restoration, and that's what I'm going to do. And I know that some of these items may have been discussed before. I'm going to go to my slide A2. And basically just mention a little bit what ecological restoration is. It's the consideration of natural or ecological end uses as alternatives or supplements to conventional property development and redevelopment. It's encouraged, but it's not mandated, especially in RCRA, and it can be achieved through either natural or green technologies or traditional cleanup remedies. Moving on to slide 3. It discusses just briefly ecological enhancements is creating a habitat for plants and animals, and the end use is restoring or increasing ecological value for land. It can be done for a whole site or as part of a mixed-use approach. And for RCRA sites, I think that's a very important point. Some years ago, Region 5 did a study of their federal lead RCRA sites, and they found that the sites that were planned to go into new use versus those which were just continuing operating RCRA facilities, over 50% of them expected to have some type of green use as part of a mixed use or full use. So the big message for us here is that don't just be looking at whole entire sites that can be returned to habitat, but be looking to incorporate ecological restoration on some of these larger sites, on the mixed-use sites. See what you can do with the buffer area. So that's a key ingredient for RCRA sites. Moving on to slide A4. Again, just to note that, of course, ecological restoration as an endpoint should not compromise our risk reduction. For RCRA, we're still into protecting human health and the environment, and that's both of those two items. Moving on to slide 5. Ecological restoration and RCRA corrective action. Again, our ultimate goal is to protect human health and the environment. But that can be done in a variety of ways. And our protective standards are often achieved by using engineered controls and institutional controls. We are working with risk-based standards often, and that means that there's a variety of ways that we can work to achieve those, and that includes ecological restoration and ecological uses. Both RCRA and CERCLA have a variety of guidances out there that talk about how you can tailor remedies to specific end uses, such as ecological end uses. One of our guidances is the guidance on completion of corrective action activities at RCRA sites. It was completed in 2003, and it discusses how you can achieve corrective action complete with contaminants remaining, and how you can tailor corrective action to specific end uses. That's a pretty good guidance for RCRA sites to look at for those of you who are wondering about that. We also are going to be putting on some corrective action training, RCRA corrective action training in the coming year. We're developing a 2 to 3 day training, but I think it's going to probably show up in several different formats tailored to the individual classroom. But we will have information there as well for people who are working on RCRA sites and trying to figure out how they incorporate RCRA regulations and cleanup in their ecological restoration projects, and vice versa. I'm going to move on to slide A6.
Can I just interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
I'm trying to find online. What is RCRA? What are you referring to? I'm not familiar with it.
Thank you very much. We get so involved in our own program, we forget to say that. RCRA is the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act.
Excellent.
And that is the act that basically regulates currently operating treatment, storage, and disposal facilities. And we refer to cleanup of the treatment, storage, and disposal facilities, which we call TSDs, as corrective action. That's a RCRA term for us.
Okay.
Thank you for the question. I apologize for not spelling that out. Looking at some considerations, there really are no regulatory RCRA regulatory barriers to using an ecological endpoint. I just want to reconfirm that. It is not considered in lieu of protecting human health. Both endpoints are important. It should be proactively incorporated into remediation strategies. We certainly have learned while doing our RCRA cleanups that the more you plan up front, the better able you are to accommodate several goals at once. And you may find that ecological restoration can achieve several goals for that site if it's incorporated up front. With RCRA sites, we encourage stakeholder involvement and community involvement. And we have always found in the RCRA program, as with other programs, that if you are able to articulate what the benefits are of your projects, you're better able to get momentum for the project, get resources for the project, and be successful with the project. I'm going to move on now to slide A7. And slide A7 is basically the items that I'm going to discuss today. It's a list of resources that we use in RCRA, but are basically available cross-program. The first is the 2004 white paper, which was done by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and the Wildlife Habitat Council, which is the WHC. The next resource I'll discuss is the 2006 guidance and clue-in sessions on ecological restoration. The third I'm going to discuss are the regional meetings that the EPA and Wildlife Habitat Council have been putting on for a number of years regarding ecological restoration or restoring green space. I'll discuss some RCRA-specific ecological restoration resources, and then I want to spend some moments talking about EPA's Green Scrape program, because I think there's a valuable intersection between ecological restoration and the Greenscape program. I'm going to move on to slide A8. This is just a graphic. It's the cover page of the white paper, which was created in January 2004. It was developed with the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council and the Wildlife Habitat Council, representatives from both of those groups and others. It includes a white paper on what ecological restoration is, as well as a number of case studies, and it identifies some benefits, incentives, and limitations. Moving on to slide A10. People probably want to know what is the Interstate Technology Regulatory Council and the Wildlife Habitat Council, so I prepared a slide here on each of them. I plagiarized these slides from other presentations, and to my understanding, there's more states belong to the ITRC now beyond the 43. But basically, the ITRC is it's a state-led coalition. It includes a large number of states, the District of Columbia, several federal partners. It also includes industry participants and other stakeholders. So it's got a pretty broad cross-section of members. Moving on to slide A11, the Wildlife Habitat Council. This slide I also plagiarized. It comes off of their website, but they're basically a nonprofit group which works with corporations, particularly large landowners, to help them figure out how to manage their unused lands in an ecologically sensitive manner for the benefit of wildlife. They have worked with companies in 48 states, Puerto Rico, and 16 other countries. They have a pretty interesting group of ecologists and other resources that they work with companies on. So a few comments about the Wildlife Habitat Council is that they've had a cooperative agreements or grants with the EPA in the past, I believe with the Water Office, with the Office of Solid Waste, and as well as with the regions, or Solid Waste Emergency Response, and as well as some of the regions. I'll talk about them more later as I talk about some of their other products. But I just wanted to give you that background as I move on to page A12, which is the cover for the guidance that was put out in 2006. And this is a very good guidance. It's a technical and regulatory guidance titled Planning and Promoting the Ecological Land Reuse of Remediated Sites. I give you a website here where you can find a copy and download it yourself. Again, this was prepared by ITRC, their ecological land reuse team, and the team included members of state, federal, industry, and community representatives. The ITRC has put on Clue-In sessions actually presenting this guidance. They have been archived. I have listed one of the archives here. They recently had a Clue-In session, I think, a few weeks ago or last week. That the archive isn't up on that yet, but it will be, so I encourage everybody just to keep checking back with the Clue-In sessions. The next few pages, I'm going to talk a little bit about what's in the guidance. Moving on to slide A14. It gives a description of what ecological enhancements are. It talks about some recommendations for successful design of ecological elements that's useful at impacted properties. It discusses benefits, incentives, and limitations to some of these elements. It provides a number of case studies, which I always find useful to look at. It includes some recommendations for improvements to foster greater acceptance of these ecological elements. And it also identifies areas where research is still needed. Moving on to slide 15, I want to underscore that this guidance is cross-programmatic. It's valuable for sites no matter what regulatory program they're under, whether it's CERCLA or RCRA or a state regulatory program. It can apply to all sorts of sites, and here's a list of them, including brownfields, mining sites, CERCLA sites, DOD sites, RCRA sites, voluntary cleanup sites. Moving on to slide A16. It includes a comment on some rules of thumbs. These rules of thumbs, actually, when you read them, pretty much apply to cleanup projects in general, which is you definitely want to remove immediate threats to human health. You do not want to compromise protecting human health or the cleanup goals. You definitely want to make sure that cleanup goals are met, such as containing off-site migration. You want to be able to articulate what the net benefit is, and you should be weighing the benefits versus risks, and that's certainly a situation where sometimes people get focused on one endpoint and they don't look at how it impacts the other endpoints around. It's focusing on sustainability without excessive maintenance, and should be done in a way which is sustainable over time and does not get compromised, for instance, with burrowing out animals, compromising a cap or something like that. Moving on to page A17, again, I said before, I think it's very important to be able to articulate what the benefits of your project are. The guidance breaks it up into environmental benefits, economic benefits, and public benefits. Some of the environmental benefits listed here are pretty straightforward: attract wildlife, biodegrade environmental contaminants, control sediment erosion, improve environmental stability, provide harvestable resources. I know Michelle covered quite a few of these in some of her previous discussions, so we'll move on to page 18. There are times when people are concerned about the economics of ecological restoration, and I think it's important to articulate that it's not always that much more expensive. Actually, oftentimes it's much cheaper, yet you can achieve the same type of risk reduction, so you need to be able to articulate your economic benefits, and some of them are listed here. At the bottom, you see possible tax advantages. And I think we may be seeing a lot more of that as people get more focused on carbon sequestration and some of the other focuses that we're seeing today. Moving on to page A19, public benefits. We're finding, and you'll see this with a lot of the Habitat Council's case studies written up, that there's a tremendous amount of benefits that can be taken advantage of, or opportunities at these ecological restoration sites. You can make educational opportunities. There can be partnerships with schools. These can be turned into outdoor classrooms and school research centers. There's obviously a lot of recreational opportunity. We are finding quality of life benefits to many of these properties, and I know that we had one of our recent conferences, a discussion, actually a very compelling presentation was made about the increase of obesity in children over the last 10, 15 years, and that the benefits of having a place where they can go out and walk with paths is actually positive on the obesity scale. There are some other benefits here that you can read. Moving on to slide A20. From time to time, we hear that people have constraints or believe that there are constraints, and really there's not that many. We can overcome them. If there's concern about regulatory acceptance, talk with your people, talk with your regulatory people. We ought to be able to overcome those. Of course, there's site-specific issues. Sometimes there's concerns about types of plants that are being used and allergies. But for the most part, these constraints can be worked with if you work with them on a site-specific basis. I'm going to move on now to slide A21. And this is a slide that discusses the Wildlife Habitat Council EPA regional meetings. They're all called Restoring Green Space, and they've been going on for a number of years now. The upcoming meeting, which will be coming up in May 14th and 15th in Concord, California, will be the Region 9 meeting. And for those of you who are interested, you should put that on your calendar as something to consider going to. The previous meetings have been held in Region 4 in 2007, Region 10 in 2006, Region 6 in 2005, Region 2 and 3 in 2004, and I think the first one of the series was in Region 5 in 2003. These meetings tend to have at least 100 people that come to them, in my experience. It's been a compilation of industry, state, regional, federal, contractors. Community people have come to them. What I've seen when I've gone to these meetings is presentation of case studies, innovative technologies discussed, technical presentations, policy presentations, and it has been a very good place for people to do a lot of cross-program networking, which I think is important with ecological restoration because so much of ecological restoration applies across the programs. And so it's really good to get all the programs talking and people talking across states. Helps get the word out on some of the projects that are going on. One of the items I want to bring a point to your attention is that the summary of the previous meetings is at the Wildlife Habitat Council website, and I've listed that link here. So you can go back there and kind of do a quick review, especially if people are having a particular type of site that you're working with and you want to find out if there's some other case studies. You can do a quick review of some of these summaries and see if you can find contacts and people who will have something that's similar to what you're doing. On page 822, I just listed some of the case studies that are currently posted on the Wildlife Habitat Council website. You'll see it spans a pretty big variety, from talking about Chicago pocket parks to the wonderful work that was done at the Ford Rouge Center. You'll see the Heifer International New World Headquarters, which is their new very green development there. You'll see there's Phytoscapes case studies. You'll see prairie planting case studies, tailings operations case studies. So you'll see it's a pretty nice cross-section there. Moving on to slide A23, the RCRA program doesn't generate all that many resources itself on ecological restoration yet, but we did do a clue-in session in 2002, and I put the website links here. There was a list prepared of some RCRA sites that have had ecological restoration, and again, some of these you may have already heard about, but BP Casper did a fabulous job both working with Soda Lake, which was an ecological, or Soda Lake, which was has become a wildlife and bird sanctuary, restoring that, as well as doing ecological restoration on the refinery site. There's also BP Wood River, where they've developed some area that was, it's a deer park and other mixed use there. DuPont Glasgow. And there's several others listed here. So, and with these, you'll see that there are contacts listed and other fact sheets listed there. Okay, moving on to slide A24. The last thing I want to talk about today, or the second to last thing, is EPA's Greenscapes program. And I know Michelle just talked about green landscaping in the past, so I'm going to overlap with her a little bit. But I want to go back to the question I got at the beginning of my presentation is, what is RCRA? And RCRA is the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. And we have a focus on conserving resources. And I think there's a really nice intersection that happens with land remediation and land revitalization and conserving resources. And when you talk about ecological restoration, there's also that intersection. The Greenscapes program talks about what are ways that you can be doing your landscaping, and that's whether it's ecological restoration or other, that reduces resource use, that takes advantage of using recycled materials in your design, that focuses on using plants that require less maintenance, less resources, focuses on using native plants, basically considering environmentally friendly to ways to achieve your goals. And I think that, so you'll see that ecological restoration projects often can use a lot of the principles in the Greenscapes program, and I would encourage people to check it out. I think I've provided the website here. Moving on to page A25, I've listed what are some of the topics that you will find if you go to the website. And on that, it includes landscaping for large-scale projects, small-scale projects. It has a large variety of partners and allies, so you can look at that and see what are some of the programs going on within that. It lists some success stories. It has a newsroom that announces new items coming up, and a list of resources. Moving on to page A26, I did here list the website as well as the link to where some of their case studies are. And just so you have a sense of what type of case studies we're talking about, I pulled out a few that do cross-section a bit with ecological restoration. For instance, the benefits of native landscaping, innovative landscaping techniques at two EPA facilities, which includes using water-efficient designs in native plants, improving turf with compost. And compost, we've had some very good results in using compost in ecological restoration projects. And I believe that's been discussed in some of the other sessions, too. Erosion control through revegetation and some work on the highway projects. erosion control of compost and roadside composting. So those are just a few of the examples of pilots that you can find with the Greenscapes Project, and it will have resources that will help you with many of your ecological restoration projects. That gets me to slide 828, which is my very last slide. And I just want to make a short note about ecological restoration and sustainability. You know, these days sustainability is becoming a very popular focus from a lot of people, and there's a lot of interest in people being able to articulate the projects they're working on in a sustainable way, or being able to articulate how it ties into sustainability. And most ecological restoration projects have a very strong tie. And I would encourage people who are working on these projects be aware of that and be able to articulate those projects within the realm of kind of the most, the popular sustainability category, because I think that will help both getting support for your projects, and I think it's also important to be able to articulate what those benefits are. There's a lot of work going on at EPA on a variety of sustainability activities, and I would just say, you know, keep an eye up on that so that you'll be best able to see how your projects fit into those areas. And with that, I will turn it back to Michelle.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah. At this point, we can take some questions on the phone. If you muted your phone before we started, you can hit #6 to unmute your phone, and feel free to ask Sarah any questions or make any comments. Also, if you're on the simulcast or if you prefer to type in your question, you can hit the orange question mark and type in your question, and we will read it aloud and give Sarah the opportunity to answer your question.
Hi, Michelle and Sarah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, this is Ken Finkelstein. I work for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and we are a potentially Department of Interior. We're a natural resource trustee, and I was somewhat disappointed, you might say, because I'm a real proponent of government working together, that on slide 8.2, the very beginning, where how ecological restoration can be achieved, you didn't mention the coordination with the natural resource trustees. You know, maybe I'm being a little anal here, but anyway, I kind of think it should be mentioned that we work closely with EPA, and indeed, although EPA has been very effective in adding some ecological restoration at their sites, it really is, in a sense, mitigation, not necessarily restoration, as we would define it. And I think, you know, some mention of how the two groups, both the trustees and EPA, work together towards ecological restoration should be mentioned on that slide 8.2, how we could really make some differences.
Thank you for your input on that. And we could actually do a whole slide on partners that we work with. Certainly, we don't do this alone. We work with a wide variety of people. That for RCRA, it starts with the owners of the property and whatever program is regulating them. But yes. Thank you very much for reminding us that there are many, many partners and many people we work with, including yours. And I think some of those are listed in some of the other sessions that we've had.
Right. Yeah. Ken actually did a wonderful presentation on end of November about how he works with EPA on cleanup sites. And also I'll mention our new website on cluin.org on ecological restoration definitely highlights all of the work that other agencies and states and just all the entities that get involved in these projects. Very good point.
Yeah. Thank you for your comment.
Anyone else have any questions or comments?
This is Maria from New York City's Department of Environmental Protection. On your last slide where you mentioned EPA's working on several projects in the sustainability area, when you suggest keeping an eye out for further resources, if I stay with Cluin and stay on top of that, is that where more information on sustainability will be?
That's a good question. I would assume that some of that may be listed on CLUIN. When we talk about sustainability, we talk about a much broader scope than just ecological restoration. You know, we talk about using renewable energy and all sorts of other things. So it's not totally encompassed by the title of ecological restoration, and that's the reason why I didn't cover it very much today. But I would assume if you follow actually the CLUIN sessions and then just keep your eye open, you will be aware of things that are going on.
Are there any other questions? Okay, well, thank you, Sarah, for your time. It was very informative. We have another presenter next. Bob Bastian, are you on the phone?
I'm here.
Okay, everyone, you can go to slide B1, and that's Bob's very first slide. And he's going to talk about the use of biosolids for restoration of contaminated sites. Bob is a senior environmental scientist with EPA, Office of Water. For more than 30 years, he's dealt with a wide range of issues associated with municipal wastewater treatment plants, including the use of innovative treatment technologies. He's managed numerous national demonstration projects and has worked closely with the Water Resources and Technology Board of the National Resource Council, National Academy of Sciences. He's worked on various interagency groups and private sector groups to develop program guidance that address such areas as the management of wastewater discharges in coastal areas, the management of radioactive materials in sewage sludge and ash, the use of effluents to create, restore, and maintain high-quality wetland habitat, the use of reclaimed effluents and biosolids in food crop production, and the use of biosolids as soil amendments in land reclamation and restoration efforts. Bob closely followed research and demonstration efforts focused on the use of biosolids to help revegetate and reclaim and restore highly disturbed and contaminated sites in numerous areas across the country that date back to the late 1960s. So, Bob, we're very excited to have you, and I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. What I would like to do is to pretty much convince you that there's some long-term projects out there that can demonstrate the viability of using I'm going to talk about biosolids, which is the organic residual that is produced by wastewater treatment plants, highly organic, lots of nutrients. This material is often composted or dried or dewatered, digested, might be lime stabilized, so it comes in various forms but it can be used as an effective soil amendment. So you could potentially just eliminate the word biosolids and talk about soil amendment, and we could do the same presentation, but I'm going to do this coming from the point of view of trying to recycle residuals from a wastewater treatment plant, in part because they have this residual to get rid of. Some of them, like Milwaukee, has been selling their biosolids as a heat-dried pellet as an organic fertilizer for over 50 years. You can go to almost any garden store and find milorganite in 20-pound bags or 40-pound bags to use on your lawn. But there's a lot of other places where the material is potentially available and could be used effectively in reclamation, restoration types of projects, and they may actually transport it and deliver it to the project site. So there's some interesting opportunities out there for restoration projects, reclamation projects, whether they're Superfund, brownfield, or non-contaminated sites, for that matter. Go to the second slide. I'm coming from the universe of a wastewater treatment plant, and we produce two products. One is a treated effluent, and the other is an organic residual. And in many cases, we look for opportunities to be able to recycle both. There are some, as I mentioned, some high-end products. On the third slide, B3, you'll see material being discharged from a truck into somebody's front yard to use as a mulch soil amendment on lawns in a highly populated area. And there are products like this. There are even some products out there that are made into potting mix material that you could use in the house without creating nuisance problems. If you get a burning question as I go through this, because you're confused about what I'm trying to cover, feel free to chime in. If you go to slide 4, you'll see that as with time, as the level of wastewater treatment goes up, primary, secondary, advanced treatment, and population served goes up, there's a proportional increase in the organic residuals that are produced. And that's what we're treated organic residual from the treatment plant, we're calling biosolids. If you go to slide B5, you should see, mine jumped twice, you'll see a representation here by EPA region 1 through 10, a breakout of what happens to this biosolids material. And the green color is the percent of the material in that region that's land applied in one form or another. So you see it's variable. From the New England states, it's a relatively small percentage that's land applied, but by the time you get to region 10 out in the Pacific Northwest, by far the majority is land applied. There's also this surface disposal category, which includes landfills or sludge-only disposal sites, which is another large percentage of where the material currently goes. Most of that land application is on agricultural land. If you go to B6, again, you'll see a representation from a recent attempt to survey how much material goes where. About half or a little more is being recycled in some beneficial use mode, and most of that is being land applied on agricultural land. There's product that's listed in the on the circles here on figure 2 on the right side called Class A EQ. These are materials that meet regulatory requirements where it can be applied at unrestricted application rate as a commercial product. And there's a small slice in here shown as reclamation, 3%. But there's one of the reasons we talk about this reclamation example is from the point of view of the treatment plants that produce it, they tend to need a large volume of material as a part of soil amendment reclamation type practices. So many tons per acre application rate versus few tons per acre means they don't have to transport the material as far. You go to slide B7, you'll see an attempt to be a graphic representation of what's included in biosolids, a lot of organic material, carbon, silica, and a lot of micronutrients. There's the issue of what about the contaminants that find their way into wastewater treatment plants and may be concentrated into this organic residual, and that's one reason why we have fairly comprehensive regulations that cover what can be in this biosolids material and still have it be land applied in recycle mode. That EQ, Class A EQ material I mentioned before means it's been treated to kill pathogens to below detectable levels, and metal contaminant levels are low enough that you could land apply it at an agronomic rate for 50 years and not exceed anything in the soil that would restrict how that land can be used. So fairly strict requirements when it comes to land application. If you go to the next slide, it's an attempt to be a comparison between Class A, which is basically been treated to reduce pathogens to below detectable levels, to Class B, which may be applied as a dewatered cake or even a liquid material of the land after it's been digested or otherwise treated to reduce pathogens to a low level, but not necessarily to below detectable levels. And as I say, this Class A material, you can find bag products, you can find composted products, you can find high-level alkaline-treated materials that are out there in the commercial marketplace that are being widely used. If you go to the next slide, B9, there's a couple of shots of some process kinds of things, dryers, composting site, alkaline treatment facility in the upper left. Go to slide 10. It's a montage of land application photos. Typically, they land apply this material either out of conventional farm equipment that's used to spread manure, liquid or dewatered material or dry material. Often it's injected or incorporated into the soil. In other cases, they've actually developed equipment to be able to apply high application rates and inject it behind a tractor or a cat that with injection with hoses and injector units to put the material down 2.5-3 feet deep that's used in some of the reclamation sites. If you go to the next slide, which I think will be 10, if I'm keeping up, no, 11, it's another montage of photos that's aimed at the idea that this material can be applied to areas other than ag land. It's also used on forest land. Seattle has had a program involving application on forest land to stimulate forest growth, either on clear-cut areas or in areas where it's selective harvest, stimulating tree growth. You'll see a shot in the lower left corner of a tree that was cut where you can actually see the size of the rings growth on the trees. There's on the right side is an example where material was applied on an area that had been severely burned in Colorado, and with growth plots on recovery rates after biosolids had been applied to try to stimulate regrowth in the burned over area. If you go to the next slide, which is B12, there's a shot from a Sproul State Forest in Pennsylvania, which is 60 miles or so north of Penn State, where they'd had a major fire come through and burn the area off. They established, I think it was 5-acre test plots where they fenced in to try to keep the deer out. And 3 years later, you can barely find the guy in here who's taking measurements. They had a lot of problems with the bears who chose to come through the fence to eat berries that were growing in the test plots and didn't recognize that it was really a fence. The next slide gets you into, which I think will be 13, a more recent set of reclamation shots in a Pennsylvania area where you're seeing a mine disc that's incorporating material in the lower left, application on the surface, and then incorporating into the material, and then initial growth showing after the area had been seeded. I see a question has popped up about what about refuse piles. Material has been used on refuse piles, and we'll get into some coverage of that as a part of the long-term mine reclamation type projects that I'm going to cover. If we go to the next slide, again, you'll see some relatively current mine restoration shots from Pennsylvania, where material from Philadelphia's land applied as a dewatered cake, incorporated into the surface with spoil material, either, in this case, it was an area where it was historic mining with little, if any, topsoil left, so the biosolids material is actually creating the soil, if you want to call it that they can then plant and stimulate production in. And that gets to the spoil material example, where there's been numerous examples where there was literally no topsoil available, and biosolids became the organic additive amendment to allow them to revegetate the site. If you go to the B15, the next slide, you'll see an example here with one shot where somebody's standing on a material with essentially no topsoil left, with an area, you might call it a control site, and then what the area looked like a year after seeding to the right, and below was actually another site with a stormwater retention pond included. If we go to the next slide, should be B16, you'll see an active site from Pennsylvania, again, abandoned mine land site, where they're using shallow trenches to put very high application rates. In this case, they're up over 200 dry tons to the acre being applied in shallow trenches, and then planting hybrid poplar, fast-growing poplar on the site. The idea of maximizing the amount of organic material that they're putting on the site and trying to go directly to tree production rather than going through a transition from grasses and legumes to potentially trees. And one of the aspects of this project they're looking at are very high rates. As I say, they've gotten over 200 tons to the acre. They're now doing some test plots with 300 tons to the acre. And one concept they're beginning to think about is carbon sequestration as a part of this kind of project, and that the credits at the current market rate might actually pay for putting in the project on abandoned mine lands, and then be able to harvest the hybrid poplar as a wood chips or a fuel source, potentially even fiber for other uses. And a couple shots here of them managing the material on the site. If we go to the next slide, which should be 16, let's see, 17, you'll see another set of shots from this hybrid poplar scenario where you have the material with no biosolids that's been applied on the upper right. You'll see a trench in the lower center. You'll see trees after 3 years' growth in the lower right. You'll see the kind of weed and grass growth you can get from this material that was put on the surface in one area next to where they were planting trees. But you see the trench in the middle at the bottom with the trees behind it showing what the material looked like after it was the second summer after the trees were planted. Okay. We'll go to the next slide, B18. This isn't a phenomena of just in the east, although in Pennsylvania, there's been extensive work because they have extensive abandoned mine lands as well as active coal mine lands. It's been used on lots of different types of areas of where things have been disturbed. Here's a shot from a site in western Utah that had been heavily overgrazed, a series of test plots where they applied material at different application rates to look at the kind of forage production that they could achieve on the site as a result of this supplemental nutrients, organic material additive on open range land, basically. The next slide, B19, shows a couple guys on a area of shifting sand dunes in eastern Colorado, and they've been able to, in effect, effectively revegetate some of these sand dune type areas and get them into wheat production as a result of using a biosolids additive. We go to the next slide, B19. I've attempted to provide a few basic bottom line type of findings of and problems that have been addressed as a result of biosolids application, low soil pH, or pH decline from pyrite oxidation in native soils or spoil, adding limestone or other alkaline materials and biosolids or a alkaline-treated biosolids can help improve the balance of calcium and magnesium along with pH management. It can also make up for nutrient deficiency, especially phosphorus and nitrogen. Some of our biosolids are up at 4 and 5% nitrogen or phosphorus, as a result of treatment plants doing more and more to remove phosphorus from wastewater. In some cases, they're adding ferric chloride as a means to precipitate phosphorus somewhere within the treatment plant, so you may get an iron addition as well from the application of the material. But the biosolids can be pretty effective, and I'm going to show a series of projects where they establish grass or grass and legume vegetation on spoils in the 60s and 70s that are still heavily vegetated today. And the biosolids can provide the long-term supplemental fertilizer benefits rather than having to buy commercial fertilizer. Low organic matter in things like spoil especially can be remediated as a result of this material being applied, and you can get a microbial population going in the spoil biosolids mixture that's close to natural soil type of microbial populations that will help help recycle nutrients and maintain a viable soil system. And in many cases, they've been able to overcome toxicity as a result of zinc and other metal contaminants in spoil type material. Some of this is done as a result of phosphate and other chemical reactions occurring in the mixtures. In other cases, it's an adsorption kind of phenomena that's binding the contaminants and allowing plants to grow and an ecosystem to functional ecosystem to form again on these contaminated sites. One of the things that they've seen over time, if you go to the next slide, B21, and using zinc application in the biosolids as an example, a lot of concern historically over the potential to contaminate clean soils from adding biosolids. And if you add a metal contaminant like zinc in a salt solution, you'll see a continued increase and at some point a phytotoxicity response. One of the things they've seen is adding this material in a biosolids matrix, in a compost matrix, you get a plateauing effect rather than an accumulative effect that you see from the salts addition. And in effect, even you can grow plants in 100% biosolids rather than seeing them having toxicity problems at a concentration. If it was present in a salt form, would create a toxicity problem. The other thing is that this plant availability response, if you have an initial toxicity, you can see it decline with time as a result of this plateauing effect, and this is a result of a 5-year field plot where they were adding annually, and if you had done it in a salt form, you would be up in a toxic form, but in the biosolids application rate, you never get into the plant toxic levels. If you go to the next slide, B22, there's actually been some studies using drinking water residuals, which tend to either be lime or aluminum additives in drinking water treatment. These residuals often are discharged into the sewer and end up being part of the biosolids. We did a major study down in Florida with very high phosphorus in soils from over application of fertilizer or from native phosphorus, because they are still mining some areas in Florida as a phosphorus fertilizer source, where the aluminum or iron in the drinking water residuals being added were actually able to...
Having a hard time hearing.
We're able to bind to phosphorus and make it not a problem as far as water quality. And just from the data summaries, you can see a difference between where drinking water residuals were applied and where drinking water residuals weren't applied as far as potential phosphorus loss from the site. Turns out that particular approach is pH limited. If you get down to a pH below about 4.5, you don't see that binding effect on phosphorus. Go to the next slide, B23. You'll see a before and after shot in Pennsylvania of a site that was established in the late 1960s. The state of Pennsylvania put a slope restriction on where they could use biosolids on land application sites, and the dividing line is the part of the field where the slope got above the state's maximum slope restriction. So the shot on the left shows an untreated site, an area, and the right hand side of the photo on the left shows where the biosolids have been applied and what it looked like 2 years later. Almost looked like a wheat field going into seed, but that was actually grass. And in the third year, legumes came in pretty heavy. They seeded with a grass legume mixture, and we were back at the site 27 years later with Bill Soppert standing in the same site with a heavy grass cover with a very thick organic layer that had established over the time. And so it was a very heavily sustainable vegetative cover that was established. Go to the slide B24, which is the cover of a of a book that Bill Sopper did on municipal sludge use and land reclamation that was published in 93 that covered long-term studies that they did in Penn State that go back to the late 1960s when early reclamation projects were established and looked over a long period of time. The state settled in on about a 60-ton per acre application rate is sort of their high maximum application rate for reclamation. They were trying to look at how much does it take to get good sustainable vegetative cover and not have to apply more than is necessary. One of the things we found in some of the contaminated sites, you may actually have to go to higher application rates to get the metal binding properties that they're after on some of the contaminated Superfund sites. If you go to B25, again, you got an open shot of a site that's 10 years after the biosolids material had been applied in the coal region. Actually, it's 13 years after it was applied in the bituminous arid region of Pennsylvania. You go to B26. Get my slide to come up. Here we'll show the upper slide was in the time frame when the was a control site to show how little organic material there was in the spoil, and the lower right photo is showing a nice deep organic layer that had developed on this site after about 18 years. The earlier shots were from a presentation about 4 years ago, and then this set of shots was from the same site 18 years after the biosolids had been applied. We go to the next slide, B27. This is a shot from a Barberton, Ohio, Pittsburgh plate glass reclamation area where they call lime lakes, where the soda ash from glass production forms these white areas of soda ash, and they had problems trying to, literally it was no organic matter, nothing there, and they've, by use of biosolids materials that have been brought in from a number of communities in the north, central, northeast part of Ohio, they've basically converted most of these lime lakes into a wildlife sanctuary area. This is one of those areas that the Cleveland Hopkins Airport had used as a marker because it's a straight shot from the end of one of their runways, but no longer do they have these nice bright white spots as a marker for the planes as they come through. And that's been done in cooperation with a whole series of wildlife groups that were interested in seeing these lime lakes revegetated. See, if we go to the next slide, B28, we'll jump back out west, Kennecott Copper Mine near Salt Lake City, Utah, where again they've used biosolids material to try to revegetate some of the spoils from the copper mine sites, and you get some fairly definitive a line on the upper right photo between where material had been applied and not applied, and it's about, I think a shot was taken 7-8 years after them, they had initiated the revegetation project. And again, they've done studies on yields. One of the things they do find is quite a bit. If you go to the next slide, B29, you'll see some summary shots from the yields looking at different loading rates of biosolids as far as percent coverage and type of vegetation. Sometimes they do get quite a bit of weeds coming in when they're using the biosolids. There seems to be a seed bank of weeds almost no matter where you work in spoil. And then in some cases with certain processes, things like tomato seeds and gourds and squash, etc., may pass through the wastewater treatment plant without being killed, and they may show up in the fields as well. Anyhow, there's been some interesting tracking of projects that are 10 and 15 and 20 and even 25 years old to monitor the responses. Now, I'm going to come back east in the next slide, B30, Stafford County, which is in northern Virginia between Washington, D.C., in Richmond, put in a major airport expansion for corporate jets and smaller planes to land to take some pressure off of some of the D.C. airports, and they got into some pyritic material that resulted in pHs in the 2.5 and 3 range, I think even some areas it was lower than 2, and they tried all kinds of reclamation procedures to revegetate the areas that they cut to put in their new landing strips, had lots of problems. They worked with Lee Daniels down at Virginia Tech, who recommended compost use in addition to some very high lime application, ag lime application rates to control phosphorus or pH levels. And they ended up going with alkaline-treated biosolids to meet that high lime need on the site and provide an organic material to revegetate the site. And the next slide, B31, shows another set of slides from that same area from a poster presentation that Lee had done. As I said, they went to very high application rates, but one of the things that this project did demonstrate was the potential for odor problems to occur as a result of some of the particular material they used at the time that came from Washington, D.C. that released a fairly strong odor that impacted the local community. The airport people were very happy because the cost of doing the revegetation with the biosolids was far less than if they had to purchase compost material to do and ag lime to do the same thing. So they took the hit on the odor problem. If you go to the B32, the next slide, you'll see again some before and after shots. One of the problems when they opened the site up is this acid material found its way into surface streams and was impacting downstream water quality, as well as having the problems of not being able to revegetate the site. And over, you know, in a year, they were able to get the site revegetated as a result of using biosolids once they got a little rain to get the seeds to sprout and, in effect, stop the erosion problem they had that was feeding contaminants downstream and impacting water quality downstream. The Blue Plains plant at Washington, D.C. has since modified how they run their biosolids processing with their line stabilization and now are producing a material that doesn't have the odor problem that they had at the time they did this project site at the Stafford County Airport. If you go to B33, we're going to jump to a project in northeastern Pennsylvania at the Palmerton, Pennsylvania. It's a zinc smelter site, which as a result of the plume coming from the zinc smelter, metals coated several thousand acre area on Blue Mountain and basically caused all the vegetation to die and serious erosion problems on Blue Mountain that were then creating water quality problems downstream. And there was use of biosolids. If you go to B36, a biosolids fly ash mixture that was put on this site, and then and the area was revegetated, and they have effectively been able to put a good vegetative cover on this highly contaminated area that had eroded down to the B horizon, and you had all this dead and decaying, it wasn't even decaying, it was just dead tree cover that was laying there not decaying because the metal contamination level was high enough, there was literally almost no microbial activity happening on the site, and they were faced with how do we deal with this contaminated site that's highly erodible, impacting water quality, several thousand acres. It's not one of those things that you could just dig up and haul off to a hazardous waste disposal site, but in effect they've created an effective living cap on the site, and the strip at the top where the Appalachian Trail crosses, they did not treat, and it's still barren, and it's still in the condition it was before they did this project in the using biosolids from a number of different areas around Pennsylvania that were then lime treated and mixed with fly ash on site as a part of the remediation activity. Then if we go to B35, you'll see a shot looking down the same slope at the smelter area in the late 1990s. After about an 8-9 year period, it took them several years to get enough material and to be able to apply to get the vegetated cover on site, and studies are continuing to track the ecosystem that has formed on this site. If we go to the next slide, which should be B36, you get another one of these after shots of the Palmerton site, which you saw the early site had literally no vegetation growing on it. B37, two shots, again, on the site that were taken in the early, it was like 2003, I think, when it was up there, and we took these shots. We go to the B38. We'll jump up. That's another one. This is a shot from the very top, looking back down. Again, in this case, you have an area that was not treated that still has the same problem today. And looking down over the area where the material had originally come from. So if you go to B39, we're shifting out west to a Superfund site up in Idaho. Again, a smelter site with steep slopes. A lot of concern over metals coming off the site and impacting water quality, and some fairly large demonstration projects as a part of the overall project management out there. And you see in the lower right picture a site where biosolids and wood ash were applied 2 years after the application. If we go to the next slide, B40, you'll see a before and after shot at the Leadville, Colorado Superfund site. It's an area right along the side of the river with, again, the spoil material was highly contaminated, essentially no vegetation could grow on it, and once they came in and land applied at very high application rates, the biosolids, they were able to get grass to grow and have actually been able to use the site for grazing cattle without excessive uptake levels into the forage. B41, you got a lead mine area spoil in Joplin, Missouri area, where again, using biosolids, they're able to effectively revegetate an area that had not had anything growing on it for many years. And then the coup de grace of projects, at least that I've run into, I'm going to take you to Poland, to south central Poland in the Katowice area, which is sort of the heavy industrial zone of Poland. Katowice was a classic smokestack city in the 60s and 70s. Into the 80s, they were beginning to look to modernize, and one of the things they had in the area were extensive piles of zinc smelting waste that had very high metal levels, make almost any site here in the U.S. look low compared to the metal levels they had. And they were in the throes of expanding and building new treatment plants, wastewater treatment plants, and generating residuals that they'd never had to deal with before, and got involved in some projects of using biosolids from their treatment plants on some of these waste piles to try to bind up the contaminants that they were finding drifting off the piles onto homes in air emissions, as well as erosion coming off the piles. Backyard gardens and soils everywhere were high-level contamination. But this stuff was really rough. If you go to the next slide, you'll see some of this spoil material that basically had no real structure, let alone organic material and nutrients for vegetation cover, that they were able to effectively get revegetated using biosolids from some of their wastewater plants. And B-43 shows some of those kind of shots, as does B-44, which gives you some before and after type comparisons. And again, there's been some interesting tracking of these sites. Lee Daniels at Virginia Tech has been involved. Some folks in Region 3 have been involved. USDA has had people involved as well. And some of the Polish researchers have come over here and worked with USDA folks. That's where, and if you go to B45, that's sort of the end of the presentation, and one thought I had was this might stimulate some questions, concerns that people might want to raise, and we could discuss relative to the use of this kind of material, this residual from wastewater treatment, as a part of ecological restoration efforts on disturbed and contaminated sites. So if folks have questions, feel free to chime in.
Great. And I'll remind anyone, if you put your phone on mute, you can hit #6 to unmute. And you can also type questions in using the orange question mark above the slides.
Hi, Bob. This is Maria Tupper from the New York State Department of Environmental Protection. Thank you so much for all those great examples. And like you said, it really just, like, whet my appetite for more.
That was the intent.
You did it. You did a good job. There's work in my agency where I am at in wetland mitigation, and anything.
Somebody's going to have to do something, I suppose, about muting. Go ahead.
I'm interested in using, in the beginning, in your introduction, I believe it was Michelle mentioned that you had successful wetland mitigation using biosolids.
Well, I could have shown you a shot from the Idaho example that I showed you with the real steep slopes, where they actually did use biosolids on a wetland to, in effect, help bind metals that were creating problems with migratory birds that were feeding on the wetland. So they ended up putting between a 4 or 6 inch layer of a fly ash biosolids mixture over the contaminated wetland sediment material, and then the wetland plants worked their way up through there. What was happening were the birds were actually picking up contaminated soil in the wetlands and creating, you know, enough metal contamination to kill the birds.
Right.
So it's pretty drastic to see the whole wetland covered with a layer of gray stuff, but in effect they have been able to sequester the contamination problem.
So have you used biosolids in the mitigation of wetlands, the creation, the restoration?
Well, we could do a whole other presentation. If we had time, I could queue it up on using effluents as a water source to create and maintain wetlands. There's some interest and have been a few projects where people have used the biosolids as an organic soil material to get the wetland soil started. But not on a continuing basis. It was, you know, if somebody's putting in a wetland in an area that didn't exist, they didn't have organic soils, and they used a layer of biosolids as an organic additive to stimulate the startup of the wetland.
And so I guess my ultimate question is, if that were the case, where do I look into regulatory information regarding biosolids that might have contaminants in it? Is there a place I can go?
On the Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds, OWOW, one of the four sub-offices under the Office of Water, they have, if you go into www.epa.gov and then go into programs and you go into water and then get yourself to the OWOW webpage, one of the areas that they have a whole division on is wetlands, and on their webpage they have a drop-down sheet. One of the pages covers constructed wetlands, and you'll see a whole lot of stuff on constructed wetlands. But I'm going to warn you, most of it is effluent-driven rather than biosolids-driven.
Right.
There are only a few places I know of where they've done test work trying to use biosolids as a part of a wetland establishment or restoration kind of project. One being this Idaho site where it was a highly contaminated wetland, and another one was down in Louisiana where they were, in effect, using it as a starter material to create some organic soil.
Well, both are equally interesting, and maybe I'll put that
but
in a
possible... feel free to get to me, and I can try to lead you to sources.
Right, and maybe a possible another clue-in seminar.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Michelle, I guess that's to you.
Yeah, I guess what I would ask folks when you're filling out the feedback form to let us know what you think about the idea of having a seminar on using biosolids-driven wetland establishment, as Bob just described, and we can certainly accommodate your interest.
I see a question was typed in about have we addressed endocrine disruptor issues at any project sites. The whole EDC issue is kind of interesting. We've got a project going on at Duke University right now where they're looking at the fate of EDCs within a wastewater treatment plant. They're looking at three major plants that are pretty much the same type of wastewater treatment and not a lot of industry, so they kind of expect the same types of EDCs, but they have totally different sludge treatment processes. So they're going to They're also characterizing the fate of EDCs on the sludge side, since in some cases they will concentrate in the sludge solids, and they're trying to look at what kind of levels come through in the final biosolids product using different processes. But then we want to look at the fate of those on land once you land apply. Part of it's going to get back to whether or not material erodes off the site, whether you get any suck, the material that's going to be with the biosolids are going to be solids associated. As long as we keep the biosolids on the field rather than have them eroding off, the best guesses are is the EDCs are going to stay on site and you'll have a better chance of biodegrading them rather than having them end up in the surface water. So we're looking at it as a potential positive thing to be able to land apply and stimulate more breakdown of some of these materials by keeping it on the land, keeping it out of the water. Let's see, we got another one here about how many biosolids applied would meet Class A standards. The last survey that the New England Biosolids Association did on it, attempted to pull data together on a national basis, said we were in the about 25% of the material met I'll go to the EQ, the metal limits being lower than you would. So the point to where you could apply it for, I think I said 50 years earlier, it's really 100 years at an agronomic rate and not exceed any concentrations in the soil that would limit what you could do with a site. When it comes to the pathogen side, which is what Class A, Class B relates to, in effect, if you put the material down as a Class B material, it's been treated, it's been stabilized, but there may be pathogens present. What we're counting on is natural die-off of any residual pathogens. So after a couple of months, you're going to be down to the same levels that you would be in a Class A material as a result of natural die-off occurring. Let me see. Do you have any data on metal uptake in the Idaho Wetland Project? The data that I saw, and I've only seen one set of data, from the investigators that worked there, basically did not see metal uptake problems in the vegetation. They effectively sequestered the contaminated zone by putting this cap on it, which created a clean area for vegetation to grow up through and get established on, and for the birds to be able to feed on and not end up ingesting the contaminated material, which was what the real issue was on the site. Dredge spoil, the Corps of Engineers has had a major program on managing dredge spoil and converting dredge spoil to soil products and, you know, doing all kinds of things with dredge spoil. So there is data out there on using dredge spoil materials in combination with fly ash, in combination with biosolids, in combination with manures and other things to create additives to use for various purposes. And that program is managed out of the Waterways Experiment Station down at Vicksburg, Mississippi. Let me see. in the presence of elevated metals in biosolids really no longer a problem. The bottom line here is the pretreatment program on the water side of that house here, there are requirements that are imposed on industry as to what they can they discharge to the sewer. The pretreatment program is one of the most successful programs that the agency has implemented through the Clean Water Act. And you can see a dramatic drop in metal levels in sewage sludge over the years. Chicago is a good example. They had a mine land reclamation program in South Central Illinois. It goes back to the early 70s. They had material with cadmium in it that was in the 5 to 700 part per million range when they started. They're down at between 10 and 20 parts per million in their biosolids today. And it's clearly a response to the pretreatment, industrial pretreatment program. And you see that across the country. The only situations that we've seen with high metal levels in sewage sludge within the last 20 years, 15, 20 years, have been very small towns with a single industry or a few industries where they're not effectively implementing pretreatment because of political pressure or other things. Old sludge beds, you're right, there are some situations. There was Madison, Wisconsin had some old lagoons, and they found they had some hot spots of PCBs in old lagoons that were 30, 35 years old. If they had chosen to pump the material from one lagoon to another, the mixing of that material would have put them down below the threshold of 50 parts per million, which caused them to be treated as a hazardous waste. They ended up making that lagoon a Superfund site, and they ended up going in and mining out the material that was acceptable level for land application, and then had to separately manage the material that had high-level PCBs in it. But that was a very unique thing, and it was a historical example, just like was pointed out in the question here. In the Class A, Class B of biosolids, the universal classification by wastewater treatment. Well, okay. The regulations that EPA established under 40 CFR Part 503 established a pathogen reduction requirement before you could land apply. And the Class A version is you've treated it with a process that will, in effect, reduce pathogens to below detectable levels. So you're talking about lower levels than you would see in manure. The Class B area has a requirement to use a process that reduces pathogen levels, but it doesn't assure you're going to be below detectable levels. So, you've had a significant reduction in pathogens from the raw material, but not necessarily gone to the same level of reduction that you would to meet a Class A requirement. So there could still be pathogens present at some measurable level is the difference between the two. And they do have to live by those rules and live by waiting periods before they grow raw vegetables or crops where a potential pathogen contamination could become an issue. Other questions?
Bob, this is Michelle. Is there information on the classification of biosolids on a website somewhere that people can visit?
They certainly can. There's if you go to our website, www.epa.gov/OWM, you'll see on the left side a biosolids button, and there's a whole bunch of stuff about the biosolids, part of the biosolids program that our office deals with. Or you can go to the Office of Science and Technology, the same EPA/OST instead of OWM, and there, under the Office of Science and Technology is where they establish the 503 regulations, and there's a whole section in there on the regulations themselves. And there's a link between the two, so you can get there going either way.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Bob?
Yeah, this is Greg Dukowski with the state of Delaware. Just as an aside, I have family in the Palmerton area, and the fact that you could get anything to grow up there is nothing short of a miracle.
It's so dramatic you can't believe it.
Yeah.
And it did shut down what they were seeing coming off the site as far as impacts on water quality on the stream that flows by there as well.
Now, on another site, you mentioned hybrid poplars, and I was wondering, you know, do these biocide sites, do you typically need something like that? Do you need a special cultivar or an engineered species? Do you need a monoculture, or
will it? The reason they went to hybrid poplar is, in this case, they were trying to go to extremely high loading rates. They're doing a number of things. One is I was trying to get up to the site about 2 weeks ago, and I haven't had a chance to physically visit this site. I reviewed a progress report and, you know, have seen data, et cetera. But one of the things they were trying to find out is how high a loading rate could one apply and still not get into problems with nitrate leaching to groundwater and runoff and that type of thing. When you put this material on the surface, you have a potential for the oxidation conditions to convert the nitrogen to nitrate and lose some of your nitrogen source. By putting it in a trench, their concept is it'll stay in an anaerobic condition and the nitrogen won't move from the site. And what they've shown when they've dug up some of these trenches is when they plant their little cultivars either above the trench or between the trench, if they get enough moisture for the tree cuttings to grow, their roots will grow right into the trench to get to the nutrients. And so far, as I say, at a 200 ton to the acre loading rate, the trees are taking up more nitrogen than that all the nitrogen is being released. So they haven't hit a maximum loading rate yet. So they're trying to find out how high a loading rate they could go to. And part of their rationale is to look at how much carbon sequestration they could involve in a project like this and potentially in the future be able to market carbon credits and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So they're after reclamation in a slightly different mode by trying to go to trees. They're choosing to go with hybrid poplar because they're fast growing. They get a cover on the site relatively quickly. They can handle fairly harsh conditions, and they can take up a lot of nutrients.
Now, what about trying to restore something more like a natural ecosystem and the wildlife and so forth that would go with it? I mean,
what's a natural ecosystem anymore? I get part of it. The work that was done in forested sites, for example, Seattle was working with Weyerhaeuser and several other forestry companies on use of biosolids on forest land to try to reduce their, I'll call it cropping cycle, reduce the years between when they would harvest, speed up growth rate on poorer sites. One of their sites they worked on was high up on a mountain area with had extremely poor soils. I remember there was a guy from somewhere in the Midwest who came out to their forestry department and was doing soils work, and he had 10% fines. That was the closest thing he could find to soil. Everything else looked like gravel or something bigger. And they used biosolids on that site and were able to increase the growth rate on their trees to a rate comparable to their highest production forestry sites, which were bottomland forest sites. And it was an issue of moisture holding capacity and nutrients being available to the trees. Now, is a managed forest area a natural system? You know, we can get into a discussion over that. The rangeland stuff, again, you get the best example, I guess, I have of a natural system is rangeland work. The USDA Forest Experiment Station in Albuquerque worked on some Bureau of Rec land 50 miles or so outside of Albuquerque, where it was overgrazed land, I mean, highly eroded, really poor conditions. And then they also worked on a area on a fish and wildlife refuge that had some poor soil conditions. And they did a, you know, single application rate. It increased the organic content of the surface profile. That increased the moisture holding capacity, provided some nutrients. They saw native grasses coming back in on their test plots that they hadn't seen in the area in 30 years that were still in the seed bank on some of these highly eroded areas. So that particular project, single application, they were looking at different application rates, any place where they put down 5 tons or 50 tons of the acre, they saw a very positive response to the organic material, additional soil moisture holding capacity, et cetera, from the additive to the rain, to this overgrazed rangeland. And the effects lasted at least 7 years, because I got there after the material had been applied 6 years earlier, and inside the fenced off area you could clearly see each of the test plots, and the area where they didn't put anything looked just like the stuff on the outside of the fence. So keeping the cattle off from grazing really didn't allow the natural system to come back after 6 years. But the biosolids had native grasses coming back, and it was looking great. So that's the best example I have, a natural system response. Most of the others are managed systems, either ag or forestry or some highly disturbed, contaminated site that nothing would grow on, that they now at least have a vegetative cover, and they might be managing it as wildlife area or something like that. Does that help a little?
Yeah, I wonder specifically whether you have any knowledge of any sites where it was used on a coal ash site.
Coal ash sites, there are some coal ash sites in the Pennsylvania work, yes, which were included in the work that Bill Sopper did when he was at Penn State. There may still even be some coal ash work going on under the existing Philadelphia program. Some of the supplemental material, I think I sent Michelle and crew like a dozen different, documents and papers and, PDF files that cover a pretty wide array of reclamation activity, including an overview of the current Philadelphia Mine Reclamation Program by Bill Toffey that gets into the Poplar Project. But again, they were trying to get into, can we put the stuff below the surface and still get vegetation to grow so we don't lose the nutrients and we don't have runoff issues and, that kind of stuff for X months until things get vegetated.
Yep, everyone, if you look on slide 46, which is the last slide, you'll see links to additional resources, and that will take you to some of the resources that Bob just mentioned. Does anyone have any other questions or comments for Bob?
You've got my access information, so you can feel free to send me questions, et cetera, et cetera.
Great. Yeah, Bob, thank you so much for your presentation. It was very informative and obviously it stimulated a lot of thought and questions from the audience. And definitely appreciate your time. And we might have you back if everyone expressed that they're interested in learning about this biosolids-driven wetland establishment that you mentioned.
As I said, there's only been a few of those. You don't have near the background that you have on reclamation and
right.
ag uses, et cetera.
Right. Okay, well, thank you, and I want to thank everyone for joining us today for the seminar. And like I said, on slide C46, you can follow the links to additional resources, and then also there's a link to our feedback forum, and I definitely encourage you to go there and let us know what you thought of today's session and any ideas that you have for the future that you would like to have us present on CLUIN. So thank you, everyone, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your week and hope to see you again on a seminar in the future.